Welcome to the Andy Social Podcast. My name is Andy, and I'm recording this intro from my car in a suburban street in Regent's Park, Sydney. Now, if you're from Sydney, you're probably wondering why the hell I'm in Regent's Park. And if you're from Regent's Park, my apologies, but this is a bit of a dodgy suburb. It's not the dodgiest. It's not the dodgiest place in Sydney. There are places that certainly rival Regent's Park, but no doubt this place would have had its fair share, and probably still does, of criminal activity. There's something a bit off colour and a bit dodgy about this place. And me sitting in my car with a microphone, headphones shoved in, I'm no doubt drawing attention to myself. I swear I saw somebody peering through some Venetian blinds at me just before. So anyway, moving along. Why I'm here, I can't really tell you, but what I can tell you is all about this week's guest. What a great segue. Stumbled through that one. This week is the first of four episodes that were recorded in Brisbane. And for people that have been listening over the past several months will know that one of my goals for 2017 for this podcast was to get around the country to every capital city and record a bunch of episodes at each place for this podcast. Oh. And so far I've done Adelaide, Perth, Melbourne, Canberra. I've done a bunch in Sydney, which is pretty much my backyard, neck of the woods, so no great feat there. And just recently, a few weeks back, I was in Brisbane. Recorded four episodes in Brisbane, probably my most varied of guests to date, and this week being the first of four. I'm really, really excited for you guys to hear these guests because they're left field, some really, really interesting people, some great stories, some great insights as to what they get up to. So I'm just chomping at the bit to get started with these and make sure that you get to hear them ASAP. So this week's guest almost didn't happen. This week, I've got Dr. Steve Salisbury, and Dr. Salisbury is a lecturer, senior lecturer at the University of Queensland. He is a paleontologist. So as you do, I go on Google searching for paleontologists in Brisbane and, dinosaurs and stuff. You know, who doesn't like dinosaurs? And Steve's profile came up, so I contacted him and we went backwards and forwards and we found out that there was only a very, very tiny, small window of opportunity to have a quick chat for the podcast. And it was literally a half an hour on a Friday afternoon. So in order for this to happen, I jumped off the plane, drove straight to St. Lucia campus in Brisbane to the university, dived into his office, and we had this quick conversation for about 20 to 30 minutes. And you know what? It sucks. Not the conversation, but it just sucks because he is one of the most interesting people I've ever spoken to. What he has done over the years is incredible. And what he is doing now, what he's involved with, is amazing. And to only be able to have a quick conversation and just start to get some momentum, oh, it's such a tease, such a tease. But Steve is incredible. And I really hope, and Steve, if you're listening, thank you so much, but we need to do a part two and probably over a couple of beers as well. Steve is just a really, really fascinating guy. He's done a lot of work internationally and across the country. He's doing a lot of work at the moment up in the far northwestern part of Australia, up towards the Broome area. He's discovered a lot of big beasts up that way. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail because I can never explain my guests very well. They can usually explain themselves much better than me. So we're going to dive right in. Everything's over at andysocial.net. Make sure you go over there and check out all the links, and there's contact info for Steve as well if you want to ask him a bunch of questions. Don't worry, I ask him heaps of dumb ones, so hopefully I've got you covered. But please enjoy this episode with Dr. Steve Salisbury. So thanks for having me.
That's okay.
Here at St. Lucia at the Queensland University or University of Queensland. This is actually my first time here, and I'm an old Brisbane local from back in the day as well. So, I'm surprised I got here in one piece, actually.
I think you did a pretty good job of navigating across the campus and finding me relatively quickly.
Ask someone straight away. I thought, I'm not going to pretend that I know where I'm going. I just pulled the first person over and said, Building 8. But thank you. I know that you're pretty time poor and you got lots going on, so I won't take up too much of your time. I've got a lot of dumb questions, so be really patient with me.
That's okay.
Do you just want to give a quick snapshot as to, I guess, who you are and what your current, I guess, role is and what you do here at the university?
Yep. So my name's Steve Salisbury. I'm a vertebrate paleontologist, but I'm employed here at the University of Queensland as a senior lecturer. So I have to teach biology, I teach evolution, I teach stuff about Australian plants and animals, climate change, all sorts of things like that. And then I also have students, so postgraduate students doing sort of honours and PhD projects. And then that usually is part of the research program that we run here through my lab. So, you know, various sort of field-based things. You know, I've been down to Antarctica looking for dinosaurs. I track dinosaurs up in the Kimberley. Do a lot of stuff in Western Queensland. My initial interest was mainly in crocodiles and the evolution of crocodiles, so right into fossil crocs, and you know, working on some stuff from New Zealand, crocodile from New Zealand at the moment. So
that's pretty cool. So it's not a boring job.
No, I you know, I feel pretty lucky that I get to do this sort of thing as a job, you know, essentially the sort of envy of every 6-year-old in the country, I reckon.
Well, I might just jump to that question straight away, because I was going to ask it later on. Is there a big interest in this sort of field of work these days with sort of the next generation of people coming through in this sort of field of paleontology?
Yeah, I think paleontology is something that interests a lot of people. You know, it's pretty amazing, all these incredible animals that have existed in the past and the story of life on Earth and all that sort of stuff. And particularly dinosaur paleontology, just because of the nature of the animals that we study.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are sort of a little bit interested in it. A lot of people are really interested in it. Lots of kids are really into it. Yeah. And then because of that, a lot of parents are into it as well.
Yeah.
I guess taking it more seriously as a science, you know, that sort of weeds out the people that are really interested in it and want to make a career out of it from those who'd rather do something else. But I you know, I always sort of say to people, if you can get a job doing what you like, then you're always going to be happy. So I've always liked doing this sort of stuff, and I feel really lucky now to be able to do it as a job.
It's I was doing a bit of internet stalking and noticed just how much travel you've done, but even just from an education point of view, traveling, you know, you start off in Sydney studying there, and then you've gone over to, I think it was the Germany in the UK.
Yeah.
Studied there and then came back, and then you've obviously done a lot of field research as well, traveling around the place. So it's not
one part of it is like to get to the point where you can apply for a job as a professional paleontologist, putting yourself through a university degree that includes a PhD, you can be living the life of a student for over 10 years.
Right.
You know, so it can be a while before you actually get a proper job.
Did you have to juggle other jobs while you were studying for that period of time, or were you able to sort of dive into sort of the field as well?
No, I've done, you know, plenty of waitering and delivery driver for a while in Sydney, one of those guys, angry guys in a white van dropping stuff off everywhere. But, you know, eventually I was able to get it to the point where I could get scholarships and things, where I could sort of pursue it full time.
Yeah. You mentioned Antarctica before. I saw an article where you'd, I think it was discovered, plesiosaur skeletons. That was last year, early last year?
Early 2016.
How did, I don't know how these things work. Do you get a call to say, come down to Antarctica, or is there other researchers from other parts of the world that sort of make plans to go to that particular area? How do you sort of get that on your radar?
That particular project was like years in the making.
Right, okay.
So, you know, there's a lot of paleontologists out there, and you know, I'm one of them that works on dinosaurs. And the thing about the world during the age of dinosaurs is that the continents weren't in the position that they are now. So right through the age of dinosaurs, Australia is connected to Antarctica. Antarctica was connected to South America, Africa, India, and Madagascar. So they all used to form one big supercontinent called Gondwana that eventually sort of broke up and things moved into the position they're in now.
Yep.
So a lot of the time for many of us that work on dinosaurs from the southern hemisphere, we're interested in those Gondwanan landmasses. So, you know, the place that we're likely to find the next most similar dinosaur to any that exists in Australia is going to be Antarctica.
Right.
And then for my colleagues who, you know, work on stuff in South America, you know, for them, there could be also similar things down in the Antarctic. So, you know, and we see Antarctica as like a sort of, you know, it's a travel route to get between all these different areas. So a bunch of us, are really interested in those questions. So, you know, you get together and then devise a research project and, you know, eventually get the funding. And
that'd be hard, getting the funding for...
Yeah, no, that was a big ask, and it took a long time to get that one together, because, like, you know, there were 13 of us.
Can't imagine it'd be cheap.
No, well, it was through the US Antarctic program. Yeah. So, you know, that meant that, you know, while all things, like, we got money for airfares and a bit of equipment and this and that, they also threw in a huge big icebreaker, you know, camp support, a couple of helicopters. So all that sort of stuff goes into it to make it happen.
And it's not just your typical, well, not that anything's typical, but a typical field expedition where you're going somewhere that's relatively sort of calm climate and whatnot, where you can get away with just sort of making do with the elements as they come. You've got to overcompensate and really sort of be prepared for extreme weather.
Yeah, so, like, yeah, the actual paleontology that we do down there isn't that different to doing it anywhere else.
Right.
You know, you head out and kick rocks around and dig holes and that sort of thing. But the logistics of actually getting there and then being there and being able to deal with the weather and stuff, that's what makes going to Antarctica such a bigger ask and a much more serious undertaking.
And in comparison, you've done stuff in Australia as well, where you're in the desert. What do you feel, the heat more than you feel the cold,
I would really like to start to expand my field-based research into somewhere more temperate.
Yeah.
You know, Sydney or...
Navigating towards the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, so, you know, the work we do up in the Kimberley, it gets really hot. Absolutely. When we're up there, and then the other extreme down in Antarctica. So somewhere in between would be good, but Brisbane's pretty good for most of the time.
Yeah, Brisbane's not too bad at all. What are the common myths that, I guess, the general public has about paleontology? Is there pet peeves that you have as far as
perception? Oh, not really. I think probably one of the things that a lot of people don't realise is just how much work goes into fossils before people hear about them.
Yeah.
You know, because in the first instance, we've got to find them, and that's not easy.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to go down to Antarctica or something and spend, you know, weeks and weeks wandering around the hills looking for something. You've then got to, once you do actually find something, get it out of the ground, and then you've got to bring it back, and depending on what it is, it can take sometimes several years to get it to the point where you can actually start to do research on it.
Wow.
And then, you know, the research then might take a couple of years. So by the time, you know, you stand in front of a TV camera and you've got a mounted dinosaur behind you in a museum, that could be something that started a decade before.
It could be someone's life work.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, do a lot of, or try to get across the background story more, because I think, you know, that's just as interesting a lot of the time as is the end product. And knowing about the animal, knowing about how we found out about the animal is also really interesting.
When you're searching for, I guess initially when you're going to a site, you're searching for areas where you're going to find fossils, is a particular characteristics of the landscape that you know is going to be more favorable to finding fossils?
Yeah, so obviously, like, we go, you know, for instance, if you're looking for dinosaurs, you go to areas where there are the right sorts of rocks that are going to contain dinosaurs. So they need to be sedimentary rocks, so things where you've had rivers or lakes where things could potentially get fossilized, and then they need to be those sorts of rocks from the right age. So, well, yeah, we spend a lot of time, we don't just sort of head off and think, let's go here or there.
Looks good.
You know, you sort of pick areas that might have been mapped in terms of the age of the rocks, but, you know, there hasn't been a lot of exploration for fossils. Or a lot of time you just go to areas where something was found before, and you just sort of expand the search area a little bit.
The place, I think, was it up in the Kimberley region? And I read this in an article as well. This is my internet stalking. I'm pretty good at this. I think you referred to it in an article saying it was like Australia's Jurassic Park. And so just the amount of fossils found in this area. So I assume that in an area like that, it's just going to be a continuous research that goes out, field studies that go out there and just continuously search and retrieve fossils in that particular area just because of the abundance.
Yeah, like, so the thing can be you can find a new area or a new fossil or a new site or something. That might have taken a while to figure it out, but then all of a sudden you realise you've got years and years of research ahead of you, which is not always a bad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's a good situation because then you can sort of develop a research program around a new area, because that's really what we need to sort of do as a scientist is be doing new stuff. So it's no use sort of doing it, doing something that's already been done before.
Well, and on maybe on that note, would you rather continuously be finding new sites, or would you rather, for you personally, as far as personal satisfaction, continue to work on an existing site that's got a lot of potential there, or just continue to find new areas that can be led to other people?
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun finding new stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have to really finish things. We have to finish stuff. So that that involves doing the research. So, you know, finding a new dinosaur footprint, you know, anyone could potentially do that.
Mm.
But then actually interpreting it and taking it through the process of naming it and, you know, presenting it as a scientifically researched footprint is another step.
Yep.
So sort of got to just balance it out a bit and, but, you know, I love getting out there and doing the outdoor part of it and,
yeah,
and exploring and stuff. That's definitely an attraction to the field.
Absolutely. I also read that if this is true, you discovered Australia's largest dinosaur. Is that correct?
Well, back, you know, sort of in the early 2000s when I sort of had just finished my PhD, got involved with work through the Queensland Museum, and that was really the start of the whole sort of dinosaur thing that's taken off in Western Queensland around the town of Winton. So back then, you know, we sort of were the first group on hand to start to make sense of some of the initial bones that were turning up around there. And these, yeah, at the time, were potentially Australia's largest dinosaur.
Has that been surpassed now as far as discoveries since then?
Well, there's been other sort of skeletal material that's been found in that area. Some of it's significantly bigger, but it's yet to be described.
Okay.
But then, you know, we've found these gigantic footprints in the Kimberley that are, you know, from animals that were probably three times the size of any of that stuff. Wow. So
you wonder where it's going to end as far as the size of these animals, because it's just incredible.
Yeah, there's got to be some end at some point. I don't think they can just get getting bigger and bigger. But, yeah. I mean, with these giant footprints, they are so big that we walked past a number of them for a year or two because they just were beyond our sort of search image.
Wow.
And it wasn't really until we found smaller examples that were the same shape that we all of a sudden recognised these giant examples as potentially being the same thing.
What's the, I mean, just to get an understanding of the size of one of these footprints from side to side, the width of one of these footprints, what are we looking at?
So the main sort of way we measure the size of a footprint like that is the length of it.
Oh, the length, okay.
So these ones, their length is about 1.7 metres. So I don't know how tall you are, but...
Oh, about that.
You could probably lie in it and have a bath if you wanted to.
It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. I'm keeping an eye on the time, so I'm going to jump all over the place really quickly. But can you just explain, and this might be difficult, but just in a really quick definition, what exactly is crocodilian locomotor evolution? I could have a pun, like a guess, but I think you'd probably be able to explain a bit better than
my take. Yeah, you obviously have been stalking me.
I have.
Checking out. That was my PhD. So just looking at the way the locomotor capabilities, so like running, swimming, yeah, and the different types of running and swimming that crocodiles have been able to employ during the course of their evolution. So that a lot of that involves looking at the skeleton, because obviously we can't go back in time and watch an extinct crocodile run and walk and swim. So looking at the skeleton of a living crocodile and trying to work out what parts of it inform us about how it moves, and then using that information to interpret the skeleton of a fossil worm.
Right.
And it turns out, like, crocs that are around today are really versatile in terms of how they move. So most people think of crocs as being aquatic.
Yep.
But even in the water, they can paddle with their feet. Some of the time they can paddle with just the hind feet.
Yeah, right.
They can use the tail, so they can paddle and use the tail, or they can just use the tail. So they can do all that sort of, it's like, you know, a person, we can do freestyle, backstroke, breaststroke, butterfly. Crocodiles have got the same sort of repertoire of things. But then they can also get out of the water and they can sort of slide on their belly.
Yep.
They can sort of push themselves along with their feet. They can walk. And then some of them can gallop.
Wow.
Say like the Australian freshwater crocodile can gallop.
Is that because their legs are higher? Like there's... Because I assume like from freshwater they're higher off the ground? Would that...
It's a sort of a size-related thing, but it relates to the flexibility of the vertebral column.
Yeah.
And then the thing is, so that's what, that, you know, living crocs can do all those things. But when we go back and look at the skeletons of a lot of fossil ones, some of them might have been good at swimming, but they might not have been able to gallop, for instance, or they might have been good on the land, but not very good in the water.
Right.
So the ones that are around today are much more versatile.
Okay. I was gonna ask whether there's been a big evolution change with crocodiles, because I think from a general public perception, it's they're living dinosaurs in a way. So I guess there's probably a perception that they haven't evolved a great deal over the millions of years.
Yeah, that's probably one of the big misconceptions, because like crocs as a group are as diverse and have got as long an evolutionary history as mammals.
Right.
Or dinosaurs, and that includes birds.
Wow.
So during the course of their evolution, they've done just as much as mammals or dinosaurs. The ones that are around today, it's really sort of the tip of the iceberg for the diversity of the group. So there was a lot more going on in the past with crocs than there is today, based on the ones you see out there.
Is it the same with the mammals as well, where they've also reduced in size over the years? So, I'll just leave it at that, because I'm not going to try and qualify that any further.
A lot of groups like crocs and mammals and even dinosaurs all start out pretty small.
Yep.
And then go through sort of phases of getting bigger, and then, you know, at various points you then get some groups within that going small again. So, you know, we might have started off with little shrew-like things being the first mammals, but then today we've got, you know, elephants and mice. And, you know, in the recent past, we've had a lot of really big things that have gone extinct, all the mammoths, and the megafauna and stuff. Yeah. And that, you know, the same sort of thing with marsupials as well.
Yeah.
A lot of groups go through all sorts of size fluctuations.
That's just the varied of the species itself, where there's so many different variations that they're moving at different paces. And
yeah, and you know, every now and then in the evolution of a certain group, a certain innovation allows that group of animals to all of a sudden do something new that really results in a big explosion. So like with dinosaurs, the evolution of feathers and then the capability for flight saw the, you know, explosion of birds. Yeah, so we're still in the age of dinosaurs. People always think the age of dinosaurs ended 65 million years ago, but there are still more dinosaurs around today than there are mammals.
I guess a lot of us are still stuck in the Jurassic Park movies and whatnot, and that's just the perception of what a dinosaur technically is. If we're stereotyping, it's this big creature and it's got big teeth and it's bigger than anything else that is around at the moment. But I guess when you look at it in a bit more detail, you can see that there's a lot of...
Yeah, well, you know, since Jurassic Park came out, I remember seeing it as a 20-year-old back in 92, whenever it was. we've had this amazing suite of discoveries of feathered dinosaurs that have really sort of confirmed that the birds that are around today are just living representatives of that group.
Yeah.
So dinosaurs never went extinct. They just took to the air.
It's incredible. what's on your plate at the moment as far as research is concerned? Obviously, it's existing stuff that's been around for quite some time. It's just an ongoing evolution, for lack of a better word, but is there any new things that you're involved with at the moment or over the next 6 to 12 months?
The main thing that we're doing now is with a lot of the stuff we've been doing in the Kimberley,
yep,
with all these amazing new dinosaur tracks, is starting to work out ways to bring those, you know, to make them more available to the public. So, you know, we're teaming up with some of the Indigenous corporations around Broome,
yep,
and the West Australian Museum to start to look at, you know, how we can incorporate information about these tracks into, for instance, the new West Australian Museum building that's yep, on the horizon now. So there'll hopefully be a lot about Kimberley dinosaurs in there. And then in Broome, you know, at the moment, you know, you can go there, and if you didn't know anything, there's like one spot you could go where you can scramble down the rocks and maybe see 2 footprints.
Right, okay.
We want to change that and get it that, you know, people can go and there'll be sort of organised tours where they can be taken and properly introduced to specific areas where there are a lot more tracks, because there are thousands of tracks up there and most people don't know about them or know where to go and see them.
So is there a bigger picture with all of this research? I mean, this is your life's work, but is there a bigger thing as far as educating the general public, as far as like what's the aim with all this? Obviously it's really interesting and we discover a lot more about the past, but how does it translate into now for a lot of people?
Well, I think what you just said is what makes it important. You know, for a lot of kids, their first exposure to science is through things like dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So, you know, engaging people in the science of dinosaurs is a way of engaging them in science.
Yeah.
And, you know, science is a great way to begin to understand the world and understand how to look after it and judge what's going on around you. So as long as we're doing that and having fun at the same time, I think it's a really good thing.
It's pretty cool. Absolutely. I keep looking at my phone just to make sure we're okay. All right. Now, a couple of really silly things. So I've got a friend of mine who has his own podcast, and it's all about, for lack of a better term, cooked conspiracy theorists. So I don't know how good your sense of humour is, but I was before I boarded the plane today, I decided to look up dinosaur conspiracy theories, and I found one website that had 13 conspiracy theories, and I've just picked a few of them, so I haven't gone through them all. But I just thought, you can comment if you want, otherwise I'll just rattle them off just for purely entertainment reasons. So the first one I've got here is, Satan planted fossils to test the faith of Christians.
Yes, I've heard that. Yeah.
That's a good one. Now, I'm not sure about this one. This one stumped me a bit. If oil is made of dinosaurs, why aren't dinosaurs found with oil? I don't know if... I wasn't sure where that came
from. Because oil's not made from dinosaurs.
Yeah, so there you go. All right, moving along. The Freemasons invented dinosaurs to tie evolution together. Apparently.
Good effort.
Freemasons are involved in a lot of things, apparently. Young Earth creationists believe that men and dinosaurs coexisted.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, on that topic, and especially with Jurassic Park that we mentioned before, if there was ever a possibility that we could bring back dinosaurs, do you think that humans and dinosaurs could coexist? I think there'd be a lot of problems.
Well, you might want to rephrase that, non-avian dinosaurs, because we seem to be doing okay living alongside avian dinosaurs.
Well, very true. Very true. Absolutely.
So you know, so a lot of those conspiracy theories really need to get with the program, because birds, you know, dinosaurs and man have, you know, been coexisting for a while.
So the young creationists are kind of correct in a way. That we do coexist with dinosaurs.
Yeah, they've been onto it.
There you go. Oh, damn. a couple others. Dinosaurs fled underground and they still exist. So there's apparently some other theories that the Germans have gone there after World War II. A bunch of people from the Illuminati and the Freemasons are all underground. They live in an underworld. So apparently dinosaurs are there as well for whatever reason. There's something great underground.
Well, they probably have a hard time without access to sunlight.
Oh, I'm sure there's an answer to that as well. There's a dinosaur in the African Congo. So I remember there was a movie in the 80s called, I think it's called Baby. And it was I don't know if it was a brontosaurus or something like that, but there was some sort of sauropod that was in the Congo. Have you heard that one?
Yeah, I think it's called the Mohibi Melmonte.
Right.
Yeah, so supposedly a sauropod that inhabits these lakes in the sort of swamps at the start of the Congo.
Interesting. I'm assuming that there's probably not a lot of factual evidence that links.
Well, you know, what's interesting about it is all the initial reports of this animal that sort of, you know, came to light when books were written about it and stuff were in the sort of 30s and 40s when we used to think sauropods had sort of, you know, they were aquatic and because they were so big and their tail dragged along the ground and they had big swan necks to keep their heads like above the water. Yeah. And that's what this thing was portrayed to look like. Right. But we now know, as the science has progressed, that sauropods don't live in the water. They might have gone in the water every now and then, but they're terrestrial animals. They don't drag their tails on the ground and their necks were probably held out fairly straight. So, you know, if the initial depictions of this animal when it was sighted were consistent with what we know sauropods to be like today, then probably put a lot more in it. But, you know, the fact that it looks like what people thought sauropods looked like back then makes me think, oh, yeah.
Well, the robotics they used in the 1980s for that movie were pretty convincing as a below 10-year-old at that stage. So I was pretty I was on the bandwagon at that stage.
Well, you know, the thing to remember is for any animation, if you do it well, it can look convincing. So even the most unscientific animation of a dinosaur can look convincing.
It's probably more true than ever now, especially with technology exponentially getting better.
The movie with Godzilla looks great,
yeah,
but no dinosaur would ever move like that. So it's very unrealistic depiction.
Does that irritate you when you see those things, the way that they're depicted, and you realize that no scientific research has gone into the correct movement of these creatures?
Well, it becomes a bit distracting because you don't see it as real as it might have been if you were convinced by it.
Can you watch it all the way through, those types of movies?
I still watch it, but you don't get as engaged in it as you could. All you think about is, oh man, I wish that animator had got it right with the foot movement. Or
that could be another line of work for you, to be a bit of a consultant for some of these types of movies, just to make sure they get it correct.
Well, some of them get it right, but other ones just, oh man,
just a way off the mark. But then they probably don't really care that much. No.
And most, it's probably just me. A few other people, they get annoyed by it, so it's no big deal.
That's a small percentage. Okay, a couple more, then I'll wrap it up. Dinosaurs went extinct because they took too long to hatch.
I'll leave it at that. And we know that from...
No, who knows? There was a bit more of a spiel, and I realised time's too precious even for me these days, and I just knew there's no value in reading that. And the last one, which is not really a theory, but I guess it goes back to the similar to the one in the African Congo. Apparently, there's a dragon that lives in the mountains of China. I don't know anything about that one, but I guess the whole mythical stories of dragons... I'm assuming that they've probably been linked into dinosaurs.
Well, linked into dinosaur bones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, giant bones of, you know, reptile-like animals found in the hills were some of the, you know, potentially the start of some of the ideas for dragons.
Yeah. You know, a bit of a layman's version or layman's term for a dinosaur, and they've coined the term dragon. Assume. There you go.
Well, yeah, dragons are a Chinese mythological creature.
Yep.
So sort of predates our understanding of dinosauria that emerged in the mid sort of 1800s. Yep. But the foundation of it is the same, these giant bones.
Well, I'll leave those conspiracies at that.
I'm surprised of all those you didn't bring up the one that all the dinosaurs disappeared, all died in the Great Flood.
Oh, well, there was one about...
So I get that all the time.
The asteroid killed them all. There was a giant asteroid impact that killed them all, but then there was a conflicting one saying that after they survived the asteroid impact, and then afterwards, due to the cause of that, they eventually died off. But there's a few different conflicting things, and I just went, oh, I'm not going to touch that. I'll just leave that. I think that was a bit above my head. So is that a common one that you get?
Because a lot of the time we find fossils in flood sediments.
Right.
But, you know, they're not all the same flood sediments and they occur at different times around the world. So it's hard to sort of see how they
could all happen at once. Washed over and
well, you know, reset. All their footprints were made in the mud
after
or during the flood.
Right. There you go. I'll leave it at that. I'm sure you're compelled later on to do a bit of your own research into some of those.
To come up with especially my own conspiracy theory. That's
especially the oil made from dinosaurs one. I'm sure that's definitely one to look into further. So we'll wrap it up. But I guess for anybody has no idea about paleontology but wants to look into a bit further or even follow what you do, what's the best way of, I guess, diving into the subject a bit more, even from a casual point of view?
I mean, there's so much social media today that is focused on dinosaurs and paleontology and stuff. So, you know, for a lot of people, if you're on Facebook, you could probably find all sorts of pages that send out things about dinosaurs. There's heaps of paleontologists these days that are on Twitter. I think you found me first on Twitter.
Yeah. So I noticed that. As soon as I followed you, there was about 20 other paleontologists to follow. I'm like, oh, which one do I start
with? Yeah, so there's no shortage of ways to immerse yourself in paleontology these days. It can come at you 24/7 if you want via your phone.
Is there a way that people can publicly track some of the stuff that you're doing? Is it just through the university website as far as things are being published? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of update that when we can. Yep. And, you know, if we've got like a big article coming out, like we'll put a press release out and, you know, up there'll be a thing on the website and then it usually sort of gets out from there. But otherwise, just sort of day-to-day things that we're doing. Yeah, on Twitter and stuff.
Sounds good. I'll put links up for everyone to check out and they can stalk as well.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Sounds good. Well, thanks, Steve. Appreciate your time and, all the best with the next expedition.
No, thank you. And thank you. Good luck with the next tour.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that chat with Steve. I've got all the information over at andysocial.net in the show notes, so go over there if you want to reach out to him, as well as all my previous guests on the podcast, as I always say, please do so. I'm going to have a bunch of stuff, cool stuff in there. I haven't even worked out what I'm going to put in there yet, but there'll be heaps of stuff, everything we spoke about in there, including some whack job conspiracy theories. And I might even link again to Salty's conspiracy theory podcast, The Hypothetical Institute. Plug, plug, plug. Go and listen to it. It's awesome. It's really, really good. Ever since I had Salty on the podcast several weeks back, I've been listening to it and catching up. And it is so funny. It is so good. So please go and check that out on iTunes. That was an unexpected plug there. So you're welcome, Salty. Before we wrap this up very quickly, as mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, this is the first of four that are recorded in Brisbane. So over the next 3 weeks, I'll have three more guests from Brisbane. Really, really cool, exciting guests. I can't wait for you guys to hear them. They're really, really good. So stay tuned for that. Now, before I wrap things up, if you want to support this podcast, there are a couple of ways of doing it, including a new way. It's a bit cheeky. I feel it's cheeky. I feel a bit self-conscious about this, but it's here. So liking, sharing, reviewing, rating, you know, hearting, retweeting, all that crap, do it. If you've got a spare couple of minutes or seconds, please click something, like it, comment, tag people, do whatever it takes, because all those little things add up to great traction for this podcast. And I can see it each and every week, more and more people listening to this podcast. So it's really, really cool. So thank you so much for those that have been taking the time to do it. If you are leaving reviews on the podcast, on iTunes or anywhere else, please let me know when you do it. And I will plug you and whatever you're up to on the podcast as well. It's the least that I can do for you guys, spending a little bit of time leaving a nice review, hopefully a nice one. But if you want to leave a bad one, you can do that as well. I think any activity is probably good on there. Lastly, I've set up, thanks to a friend of mine who will be an up-and-coming guest on the podcast, I can't say who, suggested that I get a paypal.me button thingo on my website. So if you go to andysocial.net, you can click on the Amazon portal. That link's still there. So if you shop on Amazon, please use that portal and you can support the podcast indirectly through there. But there's also a paypal.me. Now, I don't ask for money. I'm not that kind of guy. I'll only give you guys products to sell. The podcast is free. But if you feel obliged or you're really, really excited about what you hear and you love what I do and you want to sling me a couple of dollars, I've now given you an opportunity to do so. So you can do that. It's on there. It's on the menu bar. I think it's just something like support via PayPal. You just key in a number. It can be 50 cents, whatever you want to do. Flick it through. I get a little buzz on my phone and then I get teary. It's as simple as that. But thank you so much for everybody listening to the podcast. As I said before, each week is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you to everyone that's supporting, listening, sharing it around, doing whatever it takes. And please keep those recommendations coming for more guests, because some of you guys have been recommending people that have now been on the podcast, and I would not have even thought of them or discovered them if it weren't for you guys. So thank you so much. Keep them coming, and we'll keep putting out more podcasts for you all. All right. That's enough. Bye. You're ready. You're ready. Social. You're